This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses. Hey guys, and welcome back to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk all about all the ways not to get screwed in the construction industry. And today we have another one in our series of our 50 state lien laws. And today we're handling the state of Wisconsin, and I have the lien guru here from Wisconsin, Brian Zimmerman. How are you, Brian?
Hi, good morning. Good to be here, Carolyn.
Good. How are things in Wisconsin?
They're doing well. Sun's shining. It's a pretty nice day here, so.
Is the construction business busy there?
It is extremely busy, as it, I understand most of the country is. It's very busy, lots of work, lots of changes, lots of disputes as well. As a result, the delay and other supply chain issues have really increased disputes in those areas, time schedule issues, and all the things that come with that.
Yeah, like I could tell clients or people want to do talks. I never see a good project, right? I never see one that goes smoothly. So yeah, I don't have that perspective. So before we jump into lien rights in Wisconsin, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been practicing, how you got involved in construction, all the good things.
Sure. So I found construction law somewhat based on where I started in undergrad. I'd always had some interest in construction. Worked some jobs as a HVAC installer, and then in undergrad focused on civil engineering, and that sort of led me into the project management side of civil engineering, construction management. It was involved a little bit in that, involved in some internships during undergrad, doing work. Had a job doing survey verification work on Marquette Interchange when that was going hot. And then always had an interest in law school, decided to move forward with that. Wasn't really sure exactly what area I was going to focus in, kind of found the construction niche, and was lucky enough to find a local boutique law firm here in Milwaukee that specialized in it on a lark. Was able to get a job as a clerk and have been here ever since. My partner now, Kim Hurtado of, it's Hurtado Zimmerman SC, and she's been doing this type of work for I think 30 plus years. Was a great mentor, got me into doing it, and I graduated 2009 and have been doing primarily construction legal work ever since.
Awesome, that's amazing, well good. All right, so let's dive right in. So my first question usually is, do you have to be licensed to be a contractor in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin requires licensing only for residential work. There's no requirement for commercial contractor licensing other than, you know, specific trades, electrical, plumbing, those. But there's no general contractor licensing required for commercial work. But when it comes to one or two family dwellings, that does require a license in order to be able to pull permits. So as some level of subcontractor, you may not need a license, but if you're in any stage pulling permits for a project, you do need to be licensed. And there's sort of a two-level requirement. The overall company needs to have a dwelling contractor certification.
Okay.
And in order to get that, it's an application, filing fee, but then you need to certify that you have workers' comp and unemployment insurance. And then the other component is you need to provide proof of either a $25,000 essentially performance bond.
Gotcha.
Or $250,000 of general liability insurance. And having been through, you know, the other side of it, you know, looking at contractors, trying to find insurance, generally it's a one-time certification. You show proof of it, possibly a reapplication, you need to show proof of it, but there's really no ongoing
checking
of it. And then there's also a requirement that you have a dwelling contractor qualifier. Essentially, one person in the organization needs to have the dwelling contractor qualifier, which is more of an individual license than a company-wide license. And that, you know, requires application filing fee, but the one component is a 12-hour course completed within 1 year of the application.
Gotcha. And so is there a dollar amount limit on the residential guys that need that, or is it all residential dwellings?
It's all residential, anyone pulling a permit.
Gotcha. Gotcha, that would need that.
And some local municipalities have their own licensing requirements, like the city of Milwaukee has their own. It's not all that widely known, but there is a separate licensing requirement, and I believe some other municipalities do have them, although it's not a majority by any means.
So if it's required and you don't have it, is the penalty you don't get paid, or you could potentially not get paid, or is it more severe than that? I don't know.
So for the state level requirements, this dwelling contractor, essentially you're prevented from pulling a permit.
Okay.
The local one, I think the municipality can fine you. I don't think there's anything, I've never seen anything codified that says if you don't have it, you can't get paid.
Gotcha.
But it certainly subjects you to claims under some of the other consumer protection laws related to home improvement practices in Wisconsin. Misrepresenting that you're licensed, essentially misrepresenting that you're qualified to be able to obtain permits or properly licensed could subject you to some additional damages if you didn't perform properly.
Gotcha. Okay, so then who in Wisconsin has lien rights? Is there any limitation, or what is that defined like in Wisconsin?
There's really not a limitation. The standard is whether you've done work for improvement of a project.
Okay.
So anywhere from architects, engineers, contractors, suppliers, any subcontractor of any tier, even unions and individual laborers can file liens against projects.
Gotcha.
So there's really no limitation. Again, it's whether you've done work for improvement of the project. It's really expansive. Any real type of work for improvement, excavation, filling, grading,
demolition,
tilling, planting.
Demolition guys?
Yep, demolition is specifically included in the statute. Repairs or remodeling. You know, there's sometimes a question when it comes to items like maintenance, which is hard to define. Some states, and I think Wisconsin way back used to have a requirement, it was a permanent improvement.
Gotcha.
And they since removed that requirement quite a while ago.
Gotcha.
So there is some question in the industry is, you know, what is considered an improvement versus maintenance.
And I
generally fall back to, well, if you're doing something that improves the property by doing that maintenance,
it should be lienable.
It's covered. I've been in scenarios of arguments about whether snow plowing, landscaping, or lawn mowing type work is covered. And generally, if you read the statute, it's very expansive. It specifically says it's a non-exhaustive list. So I generally look at, is the property in a better condition, more valuable before or after the work was done? And if that's the case, it seems to be improved.
Gotcha. So before we dive into the technicals of how to have a lien, once you qualified as a contractor that can have a lien, is there any difference in the steps or the procedures if it's residential or commercial or a homestead or anything like that?
Yeah, Wisconsin does have a differentiation between residential and commercial projects. Residential is not specifically defined, but it's projects that are less than four family units.
Gotcha.
That are not partially commercial in nature, or not public works projects.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's dive down. What does a residential contractor have to do to perfect its lien rights?
So there's a three-step process for residential construction. And in residential, there is a differentiation of what you have to do depending on whether you're what Wisconsin calls a prime contractor, the one who contracts directly with the owner, versus a subcontractor or supplier that has contracted with the prime contractor. So what a prime contractor has to do is, the first step is they have to serve the owner with an initial notice, specific statutory notice that's quoted in the statutes. They have to serve that homeowner with it, with their contract, or simultaneously with executing the contract, they have to provide notice to the owner.
Does it be in the actual contract, or does that have to be attached?
Requirement is either in the contract or given immediately at the time of contracting. Gotcha. Or before. Mm-hmm. The issue usually becomes, well, if it's not in the contract, how do you prove that it was given?
Yeah, so it's just easier to put it in the contract.
Much easier to have it in the contract since it's required anyways and standard. And generally what that says is, hey, we're doing work on the project and we may be hiring other people providing work or materials, and those people may be entitled to a lien against the project if they're not paid.
Okay, so the prime contractor has to have this in his contract so he can have lien rights. That's step number one for the prime contractor.
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then similarly, a subcontractor has to give what's called identification notice. Okay. Same statutory written requirement, statutory terms. And that has to be given to the homeowner, the owner of the property, within 60 days of the first work provided by that sub or supplier for the project.
Okay. 60 days of first work, the sub's got to send the owner a notice that says, basically, I'm working on the project. If I'm not paid, I could file a lien?
Yep. It's like you read the statute. It's as simple as that. It's, again, statutory required notice. But so once, assuming those take place, the next step in the lien process is serving the owner of the property with notice of intention to file claim for lien.
Okay.
Can essentially be done at any time. The timing of it, the deadline of it is somewhat based on the deadline of the claim for lien itself, because the notice of intention must be served on the owner at least 30 days before filing of the claim for lien.
Okay,
so essentially giving notice, hey, I haven't been paid on this project, and if I'm, you know, not paid within 30 days, I'm going to file a lien against your property. Essentially a fair warning of there's an issue here, particularly when it comes to subcontractors. The homeowner may have no idea that the subs haven't been paid.
So at what point is the subcontractor or anybody who's not the prime, when does their lien have to be filed?
So the lien itself, the next step, the final step, is they need to file the lien within 6 months of the last date of work on the project by that lien claimant.
Okay. Gotcha. And so 30 days before that, they need to send an intent to lien to the owner. Do they have to send it to the prime contractor too?
It is only required to be sent to the owner of the property itself.
Gotcha. Okay, and then so the prime contractor, he has this language in his contract. Does he have to send a notice of intent to lien before he files a lien?
Yes.
Same time frame.
Yep. Same exact process. The only difference in the procedure is that initial notice. Otherwise, the procedure is the same, regardless of whether they're the prime or a sub.
Okay.
So after that, the notice of intent.
Okay.
And then claim for lien.
Last work, you file the lien. When you file the lien, do you have to send notice that the lien was filed?
Yeah, within 30 days of filing, you have to serve the owner of the property with a copy of the claim for lien.
Gotcha. Okay. And in Wisconsin, when we say serve and send notice, how is that required to be done?
Yeah, I was generally just going to comment on that. Wisconsin, under the lien statute, says service may be made by registered or certified mail, delivery by essentially, you know, UPS or FedEx, provided a signature required, hand delivery, the same procedures as service of a summons and complaint, or any other method where the recipient makes written confirmation of delivery.
Gotcha. Okay. And so let me ask you a question. It's effective when sent, right? Not when received.
Well, that's somewhat of a debate in Wisconsin.
Okay.
The statute specifically says delivery by registered or certified mail.
Gotcha.
Which is, the word delivery was added, I think around 2006 when some major revisions were made to the statute. There's an old case prior to the change in law, in statute, that says the time of service is the date of mailing. But once the legislature added the word delivery, it in my mind created the obligation that it must be delivered in order to be effective. So that notice of intent date can be really significant if you wait too long, send it out on the last day, and they don't accept it. I've heard of cases at the circuit court level, you know, reviewing and going, well, the homeowner rejected it, and that's sufficient to deem delivery because it was attempted to be delivered and they refused it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always a question, and obviously I always advise clients to err on the side of caution when it comes to this, that you don't want to leave it to the last minute.
Yeah.
And you know, especially if it's a significant amount, I go the route of, if we can't get service by registered mail, going and getting a process server and getting it done, so there can be no question on it.
Well, just in general, I mean, these are the deadlines. You don't have to wait that long. You can always do it sooner. There's no penalty
right.
for doing it early.
Right. And, you know, particularly on the sub side, it's hard, but usually I tell clients, hey, about the 90-day mark, that's when you should start thinking seriously about getting your notices out. One, because it's still fresh in people's mind, and two, you don't want to be at the last minute deciding whether, you know, whether you've got sufficient service or not. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So that is the process for the residential contractors. How is it different on commercial jobs that are not public?
So on commercial jobs, it's simpler in that you skip the initial notice requirements.
Okay.
And you can just move right towards the two-step process of notice of intent and then filing claim for lien.
So they have to send notice of intent 30 days before they file the lien, and the lien must be filed 6 months after the last time that they were out there.
Correct.
Oh, that's easy. Wow.
Yeah, it's a
nice and clean.
Fairly simple process. And okay. It, compared to a lot of states, it's a lot of time to do it, and which as you may imagine, does cause complications for project owners, in that you know, there may be a dispute, you may be trying to figure out whether that sub's actually going to file the lien or not, and you can't really do anything to remove that lien or resolve it from a title perspective for, you know, roughly 6 months.
Really? Oh, because you're waiting for their 6 month period to lapse to see if they're going to file or not.
Right.
Gotcha. So question, how long are liens good for in Wisconsin? After you file it, how long is it good for until you have to file suit to enforce, or what does that look like?
You have 2 years to file a foreclosure action. Otherwise, the lien lapses from the date of filing.
Gotcha. And if you have to file a lien to enforce your suit, can you get your attorney's fees back?
No, you can't. You can't include attorney's fees or interest in the lien itself. And if you were to get a foreclosure judgment, it would not include interest or attorney's fees. The only way to get the attorney's fees is through a breach of contract action, where your contract permits attorney's fees recovery.
So, and if you're a sub or material supplier, you're not going to have a contract with the owner that's going to allow for that.
Correct. You'd have your claim against the general contractor.
For
Now, if the, you know, if the general contractor has been paid by the owner, and they haven't paid the subs or suppliers, Wisconsin has some pretty significant contractor trust fund rules. They call it actually theft by contractor.
Okay.
And that contractors are required to hold payments in trust for payment of claims by subs and suppliers on the project. And if they use that money for any other purpose, it's deemed theft. It's a crime. And then in addition to that, the civil penalty is triple damages.
Ooh.
And attorney's fees. So
that's pretty steep. So you can't rob Peter to pay Paul in Wisconsin.
What's that?
You said you can't rob Peter to pay Paul in Wisconsin if you're a general.
No, you can't. And recent case law that generally benefits subs and suppliers came out that said a general contractor who withholds both the disputed and undisputed portion of payments trying to leverage a settlement has committed theft by contractor by refusing to pay amounts that are undisputed.
Yay, one for the little guys, man.
Yeah, it really has created, and it was the cause of action was always there, but the court confirmed it in a fairly direct appellate decision that made it very clear you cannot withhold undisputed payments trying to leverage a settlement or you're committing theft. And it does, I think, alter the dynamic a little bit
That's
when it
good.
comes to payment.
That's awesome. So what are the criminal penalties, and have you ever had to do that or seen that done?
I'm not sure offhand exactly what the criminal penalties are. They would be the same as theft,
Gotcha.
and I think it ranges based on the amount and the amount at issue, depending on whether it's a misdemeanor or felony. We have been through that process. Usually on the criminal side, we've been assisting homeowners who have paid prime contractors who have just usually when you can get the attention of the police and DA is when essentially the homeowner has paid a general contractor and they've just absconded with the money.
And then
It's
there's a
just
bunch of liens,
gone.
and then they're.
Yeah, they got all these liens, the amounts pile up, the homeowner has to pay off the liens, they paid twice. And it's sometimes hard to get some attention on it, but there are a number of municipalities and counties that do take on these cases and prosecute them. And there have been significant, prosecutions of those crimes.
That's awesome. Okay, so let's dive in for a second. For material suppliers, I always get the question because it's different in all 50 states. What level of incorporation does a material supplier have to prove to have a lien? So, like, does it have to be delivered? Does it, they have to prove it was actually used there? Can they just, what does that look like in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the standard in the statute is that the material work must be used or consumed for improvement of the land.
Okay.
There's no test that I've seen in Wisconsin that, regarding incorporation or not.
Gotcha.
Generally, though, you'd have to meet the standard it must be used or consumed. Delivery to the project site would be pretty good evidence that it was used or consumed. But if there was evidence that, hey, it was delivered and then the prime contractor took that material and used it on a different project site, it might be an issue of fact. But if that were the case, I'd say you probably aren't going to be entitled to a lien
Gotcha.
against the first project.
Which kind of answers my next question for like materials that are specially fabricated, made specifically for that job, but are not delivered. Can material suppliers have liens for that?
I don't believe so.
Because the definition is used and consumed, so if it was not even sent there, it wouldn't be.
Right. I generally side towards no, because again, not used or consumed. The issue does it could present some interesting arguments though about, for instance, architectural plans can be the basis of a lien, and they're not directly used or consumed. Although I guess they're used for the improvement of the property. So I guess it depends. What of that work got to the specially manufactured materials? Were there designs that went along with it that
Gotcha.
were used for advancement of the project, although the materials never. So I think there, there's a little
Have a creative
complication there.
argument.
Yeah, exactly. So
Creative
I guess my
argument.
point is if I had the client in that case, I wouldn't say, oh no, we're not going to pursue the lien at all. You're out of luck. It's probably more of a matter of, well, we need to get into some of the details of this to figure out whether we have a basis to assert a lien or not.
Gotcha. And is the if you have a construction lender, are they at all involved in the lien process?
Generally, no. I
Okay.
mean, they have their interest in making sure the liens are removed from the project, but they're not
They
by
don't need notice
statute.
or anything like that.
No notice required to them. Although, The initial notice is given to the homeowner. They do include in it that you should give a copy of this to your lender.
Gotcha. All right, good deal. Okay, so public work projects. So basically, you can't have a lien on public work projects, right? I mean, I think it's pretty much. Can you have a lien on public works?
Generally, no.
Gotcha.
So the way the statute requires is that at a certain threshold dollar amount, state and local governments are required to be bonded. And if they're bonded, then there's no right to a lien against those projects.
Gotcha.
The statute doesn't, the whole lien statute doesn't specifically exempt public projects or public property from liens, but it says if there's a bond on the project, there's no right to a lien.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
So I've seen scenarios where a bond was required but never obtained,
and
it never got to a court decision on whether the liens were valid, but you know, subs were filing liens and making claims against the project, which you know arguably is permitted if that bond isn't in place.
There's not a bond. Cool. All right, so they have to have a bond. So does the prime contractor provide the bond, or how does that work?
Yeah, prime contractor is required to provide on public works projects both payment and performance bonds.
Okay, so then somebody that works on a public project that doesn't get paid, what is the process of number one, how do they get the bond, and what do they have to do to file a bond claim?
So a bond claim must be filed within 1 year of the last work on the entirety of the project.
Okay.
So that's the one timing requirement is claim must be filed within 1 year.
Gotcha.
Is a prerequisite to being able to file a claim as a sub or sub supplier. There's a notice requirement that you must give notice to the prime contractor within 60 days of the first work of performing by that claimant.
Gotcha.
But there are some exceptions that if that sub is listed in a contract or document appended to a contract with the prime contractor, if the amount is less than $5,000, or if the claimant is an employee or laborer.
Gotcha.
So you often get into this question of, well, what is sufficient notice to the prime contractor that they're doing work? There's, in this case, there isn't a statutory required, you know, blurb that's required to be given. So, you know, you could look at emails or, hey, we're doing work on this. Here's my submittals for the project. Those sorts of things, you know, generally can open the door to saying, oh, look, there's notice here. You know, they showed up at a job meeting and there's meeting minutes of it. So it's, you know, a lot of subs don't, you know, do an overt notice to the prime contractors as far as I've generally seen in the industry. Okay. And usually it's after the fact when someone's not paid, they're coming back later and trying to figure out, do we have, you know, is our name listed in the prime contract somewhere, or the schedule values or something like that.
So if you're in a public project, it would just be a good rule of thumb to send notice to the GC, hey, I'm working on this project, certified mail or something like that. And they could be like, hey, here you go. You got it. And so then how would a sub or a prime get or a sub or a material supplier get a copy of the bond to file a claim?
So on public works projects, I mean, other than just simply requesting it from the individual involved, the easiest probably would be to do an open records request to get it. I don't believe public works contracts require it, and if they do, you know, that whether the prime contractor cooperates or not. So on private projects, you can also post a bond, and if you do, it avoids lien rights for the project, similar to a public works project. So it's essentially this very similar process. If the contract with the prime contractor requires a bond and they provide a bond, then the project isn't subject to lien.
Okay. Did they file that bond in the real property record so everybody could see it? Or
no, it's not filed anywhere. That statute specifically says that a sub essentially can request a copy from the prime contractor and they're required to provide it.
Gotcha.
But having been in that scenario, they don't necessarily do it.
Yeah.
Usually the way to get it is to start the process of filing the lien. And they go, wait, 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 you know, you can't file a lien, there's a bond. And say, well, show me a copy of the bond. And
you can file on that instead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then they basically, if you wanted to file a claim on a bond on a private project, the timelines would still be, would the timeline still be the same?
Yeah, the exact timelines, the exact notice requirements and exceptions, the exact same procedure.
Gotcha. So on your public works project, you have a year after the project's complete to file your bond claim? Did I understand that right?
Yeah, you have 1 year from the date of final completion to file the claim, although you can file it sooner.
Gotcha. And then how long is the bond claim good for? Do you have to, before you file suit to enforce it?
So the claim is actually a filing of suit. So okay. you need to file suit within 1 year of that last work.
Gotcha. And then if you file just on the bond claim, can you get your attorney's fees back for that? Or do you have?
No, there's no attorney's fees or interest component.
Still under the contract.
Right.
Gotcha.
Well, Wisconsin also has another process on bonded projects, both private and public,
uh-huh.
that's generally referred to as a lien on funds.
Okay, tell me
and
about that.
And so on a bonded project, you can submit a claim to the owner,
okay.
you know, either public or private, and notifying them, I haven't been paid, this is the amount due, and I'm making a claim on funds for the project. And that owner, public or private, is required to withhold those funds from payment to the prime contractor. And there's a notice and timing of dispute requirement on the prime contractor side. But generally, that owner has to hold those funds until resolution of that. So if you're not paid and it's a bonded project and you're at a point, well, I don't want to necessarily file suit yet because that's going to take a lot of time and effort. One way to make yourself known and to raise the issue in front of the owner is to file a claim on funds. There's no specific deadlines for doing it. But once that money's paid out, there's no obligation on the owner anymore. So you got to make that claim before the money's paid out.
So is that just a notice that's sent certified mail, or does it have to be filed someplace?
No, that's just a notice to the owner, certified mail, same service process. Yeah, there's no specific statutory form or specific requirements of it, of what needs to be in it, but there's a sort of a short statutory provision on it. That.
Cool. And if they pay it out after they got that notice, they'd have to pay again potentially?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it then allows a direct claim against the owner.
So if the bond is there, you'd have a claim against the surety, but you could have a direct claim against the owner for the payment of funds after you have a lien on the funds.
Yes.
Cool. Very cool. Awesome. All right. Did I miss anything? Or is there anything else you want to add?
I don't think so.
Okay. Wow, that's easy. You wouldn't have to write a book to get liens right in Wisconsin. So that's kind of really, you know, like Texas is pretty complicated. California is pretty complicated. There's a lot of and there's other states like Wyoming and Iowa, which are real simple, which is that's what I think it should be. The one thing that I, you know, kind of reviewing Wisconsin is that it's kind of long, right? So mm-hmm. What do you tell your clients? Yes, these are the rules, but what do you tell them is their best bet at making sure that they get paid?
Yeah, usually it's the 90-day, at 90 days, if you haven't been paid, you should be starting the lien process. And I understand that can be challenging with the timing of payments on projects, and they get extended, particularly public works projects, although you're protected with the one-year bond claim. So usually at that 90 days, start the process, start getting a notice of intent out, so that you're in place to be able to file that lien. Because a lot of times once that notice of intent goes out, there's negotiation, there's communications back and forth. And a lot of times those communications can be useful. The threat of the lien can often be better leverage than the lien itself.
Absolutely.
You know, the owner's going, no, don't file the lien against project. I don't want a lien. It's going to mess up my title. And they have more of incentive to avoid the lien and the hassle of it. But once you file it, they're likely going to have to do something to address that lien. And that may not always be payment. It may be escrow funds with a title company. And once they do that, they may go, well, all right, you filed the lien. I don't like it, but it's not directly affecting me at the moment. Yeah, so
right
I can ignore you for a while. So again, the threat of the lien is often better leveraged than the lien itself, because once you file the lien, if the owner is satisfied and sitting there, I tell, you know, owner clients all the time, if you're not looking to refinance, close any financing, sell your property, you might as well just sit it out and see if they're going to actually file the foreclosure.
Yeah.
Because filing a lien is very inexpensive. The filing fee is
$5. Yeah.
But pursuing a foreclosure gets expensive very quickly.
Absolutely. Especially if you can't get your fees back. That's something definitely to consider.
Right.
Well, awesome. I thank you for your time today, Brian. And we'll put all of your contact information in the show notes, and so people could reach out to you if they have any questions. Do you have a website or an email that we should refer them to that you want to let them know about?
Yeah, HurtadoZimmerman.com is our website.
Awesome.
And our contact information is all there if anyone needs to contact me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Brian. I appreciate you taking the time today to explain all this to us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Thank you.